Welcome back to the Shift Extension podcast, or paramedic podcast, I should say. I'm joined once again by Sonny Whitfield. How are you, mate?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
It's been too long.
It has been. We need to do these more regularly, but we got an exciting guest today.
We do. We're joined today by a gentleman by the name of Dustin Osborne from Queensland. He's not a paramedic, but he does work and do some paramedicine, and we're going to get him on today to just pick his brain and share some experiences. So, Dustin, welcome to the podcast, mate.
Hey, guys. How are you going?
Good. How are you?
Thank you. Yeah, really good.
We'll start off by just introduce yourself to the listeners, Dustin, and what your current role is and where you're working at the moment.
Yeah, so my current role is general duties police officer, working in Fortitude Valley Police. I've been there now for coming up to 15 years, so wow. My diversity in policing is extremely narrow, but pretty diverse in the sense of what we actually deal with the gifts that Fortitude Valley just give you every single day.
I've never worked in Fortitude Valley, but I've certainly walked through there before, Dustin. And I tell you, it's got a bit of notoriety about it.
Mate, it's eclectic, I'll give it that.
It's a diverse scope of people.
It's got character.
Yeah, yeah. If it was a house, you'd just knock it down and start again. You wouldn't renovate.
So, Dustin, you're the first police officer we've had on the podcast. So, congratulations.
Thank you.
And you've found yourself in a bit more of a medical role, or providing medicine as part of your role as a police officer. Where did that start? Take us back to where it all began and what kind of sparked your interest in pre-hospital medicine.
The pre-hospital medicine for me has gone far, far back, even sort of before police. I've always had a massive interest in doing first aid, essentially. I'm living the failed dreams of a firefighter, which, you know, they never took my application. That's a different sob story later on. They were too busy, all right? This is not me. So realistically, I had always done my, advanced first aid, advanced CPR when I was going through those processes to get into the fire department. So that was probably where my real initial sort of, interest got sparked there.
Mm.
Pushing forward, I got over the failed dreams of being a fiery, joined the police as a good second backup, worked all the way through until probably about 2000. And so I joined in 2008. In 2015, I found myself as one of the lead instructors writing the curriculum for the Active Armed Defender Project.
Okay.
So what we were doing with that was looking at what police need to do to stop active armed offenders. So this realistically comes straight off the back of the 2015 Paris attacks.
Yeah.
Like the Cafe Precinct, Bataclan Theatre, that whole multifaceted attack. So during that actual project and working on that, I sort of really stepped back and thought, if a police officer gets hurt in this, what are we going to do about it? Because we're doing room entry drills, we're really pushing through and really pushing the envelope on general duty skills. So what are we actually going to do for ourselves when we actually get tagged, and need to do something for ourselves? So I sort of reached out to a couple of the organisations around us. I looked inside as well to our, CERT teams as well. So our sort of special emergency response team, spoke to those guys and then looked at basically sort of some casualty recovery programs.
Mm-hmm.
From that, we implemented a specific man down and injury sort of management, little 1 hour sort of learning session as amongst the whole curriculum. That then got found out to be probably the most engaging element through that whole 5 day course. And people absolutely just loved it because it was something that the police had never done before. We'd always looked at, basically spraying, shooting, tasering people all the time, but it's just like, okay, what's that next iteration? What do we do then? The job's definitely not done. And as we know from the Paris attacks, when you're working in a hot zone, ambulances just aren't going to go there. So we need to be somewhat self-sufficient for ourselves and also the people that we're actually trying to protect in that moment. So that then led on to the 2017 project of the tactical first aid.
Yep.
And that was sort of, that was my baby, which realistically looked at sort of mass hemorrhage controls, techniques, dealing with thoracic trauma, stuff like that. So stuff that the police had never even conceived before, we were now doing. For us and as police, we are now, 5 years into that curriculum?
Mm-hmm.
We've probably got well over 100 lives saved and probably 400 or 500 deployments of those skills. So,
wow.
Is this something that's being rolled out to every police officer?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So in Queensland, recruits commissioner will do this.
Yeah.
Unless okay. there's been some little sort of thing in just in the last sort of COVID era, it definitely, in the first interim, it was every single police officer was going to be doing this training.
It's interesting, even hearing this from an external perspective, because obviously my background's paramed. But I mean, I'd imagine that US listeners are probably laughing uproariously at this point, because they've sort of had tactical first aid in elements for a long time. Why has it taken us so long?
It's a really great question. Look, I think it's one of those things that you look at US models and things like that, and, you know, the Columbine incident was probably one of the first major sort of incidences and shootings over in the States that really brought life to the fact of, hey, police are more responsible for saving and reducing sort of the deaths that occur in these incidences. So they've always been 15 years ahead. And that's the way I sort of look at it. It's like you look at Columbine and what they started to do after the Columbine shooting to when we did it, it was basically 15 years, 16 years. So they're ahead in their advance because they've got those threat profiles where we don't. And
that's a valid point. There's obviously a lot more weapons on their streets than here. We don't see the same profiles that they do.
Yeah, exactly right. But you know what? I think the big thing is as well is if you really start to dig into it, I don't think America has that many more weapons than anywhere else in the world in the sense of, you know, weapons, right? So the thing is they've got probably one of the biggest media outlets in the world. And if you look at sort of attacks that are occurring every single day in Eurasian countries, Malaysia, in areas like that, like they have mass knives attacks, just no one hears about it because they don't have the media sources to be able to pump it out to the greater world. Populated Muslim countries as well, like they've massive acid attacks and things like that. And it's just one of those things. So if you want to start really digging into what threats are out there in the world and what's happening on a daily basis that police need to respond to, that's, you know, weaponization is huge, you know, from knives to acid to chemical attacks. It happens daily. It's just, you just know about it because America loves to talk about it.
Everyone loves to listen to it. Yeah. I think it's a valid point you raised too, that in a lot of these hot zones, you don't find ambulance crews. One of the things, or one of the strategies that has been discussed in the past, is embedding paramedics in tactical teams. But we're not talking about tactical teams per se, we're talking about general policing and upskilling the general police population. That's right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And so what kind of skills are we talking that you guys have really been growing over the last 5 years?
The major skills that we look at is sort of mass hemorrhage control. So tourniquet and wound packing is our two biggest things that we really focus on. After that, we look at basically thoracic trauma. So our go-to is chest seals for that sort of open pneumothorax injuries.
And now every police officer in Queensland has that capability.
Yeah, that's right. So they have the capability But they, every police officer has the skills and the training.
Yeah.
And then embedded into our vehicles, and also a lot of sort of stations as well are purchasing their own tactical first aid kits. They have the equipment. So a big thing that I harp on about all the time is you do not have capability unless you have skills and equipment. So you've got to have both for a capability to exist. And that's what one thing that we have been able to achieve is to give people the skills, but also the equipment.
Oh, that's great. Well, firstly, congratulations on the rollout out of the program. Have you found yourself, like, you work in the Valley, how often would you be responding, or have you found yourself delivering a medical capability as part of your role in the Valley?
Look, I'm probably not a good person to ask for it, because I definitely go out and look for it, and I definitely get a lot of shit hung on me from everyone around, because I'm
still living that firefighter dream, eh?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, I turn up in my green police uniform and everyone's like, yeah, okay, you finally jumped, mate. But I would say probably easily once a week.
And of that, the origins of this program was around tactical first aid, and so specifically looking at trauma-related injuries and penetrating injuries. Obviously, in Australia, that makes up quite a small proportion of all of the presentations and a statutory ambulance service or any paramedic working in public or private would attend to. It's quite rare to have that presentation. In your work, how much of the stuff that you're going to is that tactical penetrating trauma, and how much of it is other trauma or mental health or medical presentations? What's kind of the breakdown there?
Yeah, from sort of trauma to actual medical, I'd say it'd be probably a good 50-50 split.
Mm-hmm.
The penetrating trauma that we look at where we're dealing with it, our biggest charter for that is mental health. And we're finding that mental health patients, especially now, they're really ramping it up. So, you know, back when I joined in 2000 and, well, I become active in 2009 after leaving the academy. But if you went to a mental health patient, they would generally slice and cut themselves. But what we're finding now is the level of mental health is very high. Like, they're actually stabbing themselves repeatedly in the stomach, in the thighs. You know, I've personally attended to probably I'm on my fifth or sixth cut throat now. Wow. And it's all self-inflicted. So when we go to those incidences, they are mental health, but you are dealing with just outright penetrating trauma. And in a lot of those cases, you're doing it in a sense where ambulance won't enter. So because it is still sort of declared a hot zone, that person is still armed, they're still active, and they're still posing a threat. That is our biggest charter, is a mental health aspect to it. But, you know, direct violent trauma where there's stabbings and things like that, we see a lot of it in that inner city sort of nightlife entertainment precinct, because you've got all the clubs, huge amounts of alcohol, drugs, and Fortitude Valley has probably the highest transient population, I would suggest, in the greater sort of southeast area, okay, mm-hmm. like excluding Gold Coast and things like that. But, you know, every Friday, Saturday night, you've got people from all over, you know, probably a good 70K radius all coming in. So that brings with it all its own issues. The flip side to that as well is the medical aspect is people who are suffering medical episodes through poisonings, you know, the people who have had way too much alcohol, drugs, or the issues of, you know, the polysubstance there, they become our problem as well. And the issue is like that it's not so much that ambulances aren't available, but they're a reactive force where police are proactive. We're already out driving around interacting with the community. So we're straight up, we're Johnny on the spot in a lot of those cases with medical as well.
Where do you see this, I guess? I mean, you've started obviously increasing the skill set to enable police officers to certainly be Johnny on the spot and, you know, utilize new skills to stop hemorrhages and plug chests and things like that. I mean, that's all fantastic work, but there's a much wider scope, obviously, that you find. Where do you see... I guess further upskilling or benefit coming from, you know, training police in dealing with mental health patients, drug toxicity, things like that. You know, do you guys carry AEDs in the car for the occasional cardiac arrest that you might find?
The simple one first is I would love AEDs in the car, and I've needed one in two recent events, you know, straight up. So in those cases, we've had to basically pilfer. So, you know, first off, thanks for Hungry Jack's. I think we owe you an AED.
Did you give it also, back? Or?
Yeah, in pieces.
Yeah, pretty much, mate. Yeah.
On and broken.
Look, it went back in good condition, but it definitely was down a set of pads. And then also some random place in Valley Metro as well, we owe you a set of pads as well. So
it was actually a grant from the Queensland government several years ago that started planting defibs across the community, and they wanted somewhere central that a lot of people visit. And so they actually decided to start planting defibs in petrol stations, which amused me thoroughly because one of the safe principles of safe defibrillation is a non-explosive environment, but I guess we omitted that one. And so check a fuel station, maybe drag the person out of it, but, you know, Hungry Jack's, petrol stations, you take your pick.
Yeah, no, we'll see how we go. Hopefully we don't have any of those ones come up on us, but we'll get them far enough away anyway.
Yeah. It would make sense to have AEDs in police units, though. Like you said, they're a proactive force in the community.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, my big argument's always been, like, you look at the Seattle model, where every government vehicle's in Seattle, every government vehicle must have an AED on it. And that basically goes from, you know, if like the meter maid sort of ticket checkers were out doing their patrols, they'd have an AED in the car. If it was,
they probably also caused some cardiac arrest on the Gold Coast through the 90s, but that's cool.
They probably did too, but just drumming up their own business and creating stats. So, but the reality of it is with those guys, that they've actually taken their cardiac arrest survival rates up to 40%. So, you know, the proof is sort of there for early access anyway. If we had them, we can use them.
Where do we draw the line, though? Because when you start, I guess, taking the medical skill sets to a much higher level, where do we draw the line between being a police and being a medical first responder? Is there a line to draw?
Yeah, there's definitely, 100% there's a line to draw. My idea, though, is we need to really heavily push that line first. Like, you're never going to know where your line is until you push it, and you never know what you actually can achieve without pushing a line. So, you know, there's a lot of people out there that have told me that what I'm doing already is too much, should can it. You know, we're not paramedics, it's not our job. And it's like, yeah, okay, cool. But at the same time, if those individuals were injured themselves, I bet you they'd want the police officer not to be standing there like the best dressed bystanders that we used to be and actually do something. So if we can get in there and actually start pushing some of these lines and start actually looking at where that happy medium is between education, training, equipment, and also just viability, you know, like what's the point of teaching QPS how to intubate someone? It's like, well, when are you going to do that? And then you don't have,
I look at it from a competence perspective as well, because if skills aren't used,
absolutely.
And we find this in paramed as well, if skills aren't used, you know, obviously the level of care drops as you try and implement, but the competence would be a question. And I guess that's where I was asking about where we draw the line, because I agree, having a police force that can respond, you know, it. If I'm injured or I'm ill, I don't actually care what the person who's assisting me is dressed like, as long as I'm getting assistance. But I guess we need to make sure that assistance is beneficial from both a skills, knowledge, and competence perspective. But it's it's an interesting place to be working. I guess everything's unpopular until it's proven.
Traditionally, we've always looked to ambulance services or jurisdictional ambulance services to be the provider of out-of-hospital medical care. And, you know, the structured model of you ring 000, if it's on fire, ring the fireys. If it's a violence issue, you ring the police. If it's a medical problem, you ring the ambulance. And if your cat's up the tree, you ring the fireys as well.
That's what Dustin wanted to do.
Okay. Oh, you ring Dustin. but now, like with the, especially in some of the metropolitan areas where it's quite busy, and there's certainly restrictions to access to ambulances due to, you know, ramping and increase in population size and all those other variables that exist. And it's not an Australian problem. It occurs all over the world. And it will keep on occurring for years to come. The availability of for an ambulance can sometimes be quite constrained, either due to a just complete lack of available units or just the distance that needs to be travelled. So do we need to start looking at our other emergency services? Because if we think about those services as their number one objective is the preservation of life, right? If we look at that, then should be utilizing all those three services in situations where that applies in a medical capacity, like a cardiac arrest or a major hemorrhage. But also, how do we balance that against those other services still being able to do their jobs? Like if we send a fire truck to every cardiac arrest or two police cars to every cardiac arrest, how do they then do their job?
And mate, I think you've absolutely nailed it there. And I think what it comes back to is a couple of things. It's like we need to look at like every single service, be it police, fire, or ambulance. The whole point of what we're doing is to preserve life, and except probably the ambos, but property as well. So, you know, the fires are out there trying to save lives and save property. We're doing very much a similar thing.
The ambos are actually breaking stuff to access. So it's the opposite to protecting. Apologies, you know.
When you guys call out for a door to get knocked in, I'm never upset about it. So don't worry.
That's only because we've already tried and failed. So
those weak little spaghetti legs.
I'm out of the gym after this, Nick.
So, mate, all in all, I think it's just one of those things that if we look at our actual core responsibilities first and foremost, we learn what we're supposed to be doing and what we need to come back to. And then to answer your question before is, what's that line with that medical aspect? It's sort of, for police, if we know how to treat something, we're more likely to use that actual knowledge to our own advantage. Because one of the big things that we have as police is knowing the difference between medical and behavioural issues, which is also for our mental health interventions as well. Whereas a great example of that is just recently I attended a job where a guy was highly erratic. He was seeming very violent. But it wasn't behavioral. It was actually a medical episode that he was going through. And police initially responded to it and treated the issue with what they were presented, which is exactly what you would do. But then after a certain amount of time, if you've got the knowledge to then step back and go, hang on a minute, my knowledge and my education and all my skill and everything else is coming back to say that this is probably not behavioral because I've tried everything. And maybe this is medical, which this person won't diffuse. So, you know, and then when they start to go downhill or you recognize that as being a medical issue over a behavioral issue, then you can actually call the appropriate agency in. Be it the ambos to do what they need to do. In that instance, that person went into basically like a full drug stupor, collapsed, went unresponsive, and you know required sort of you know mechanical airways, assisted breathing, and defib later on. So, for police to have education and training, we can apply that in so many different fields to actually better how we function. And to better support the community as well, because if we left that for what it was, that would have been a death in custody because we were dealing with that as behavioural, not medical, by looking at it through a different sort of scope and a different lens.
It's been awesome to hear about it because, I mean, it sounds like a success. You know, everything that you guys and girls have been doing since, you know, you started rolling things out in 2017, it's obviously impacting the lives saved, the preventable deaths, which is amazing. Where Where do you see this going, Dustin? If Dustin had his way and everyone was going to listen to Dustin, I'm curious, where do you see this going?
Mate, to be honest, I don't think I would really take it much further, because it is that thing of what we're saying. It's just like, I'm not going to teach people how to intubate based on the fact of skill degradation by how much you use it. It just doesn't work.
Dustin just drew the line there. That's the line in the sand.
Copy.
Yeah. look, if we could bring sort of like nasal airways in it, maybe some bag valve, things like that, that would be really good for us and AEDs.
Yeah, you could use the surf life-saving model too. I mean, that's what they're teaching clubbies to do out on the beach. Why can't we have police proactively out in the communities with these? I mean, if you can breathe for someone to keep an airway open, you're potentially going to prolong their life chance to live.
100%. And it's sort of one of those things that I think medical dogma plays a lot of issues for the police, where there's a little bit of knowledge but not enough. You know, you look at the dogma that sort of surrounds the use of nasal airways or even sort of spinal immobilization and things like that. We just need to be a bit smarter and a bit wiser and look at the greater good instead of just where we can mitigate our risk.
Dustin, we're going to have to wrap up, but I've got one more question for you, mate. I got a speeding fine the other day. Can you help me out with that? I'm joking. Sorry, I was joking.
No, that's fine, mate. If you know anyone in National Parks and Wildlife, we've got a fine as well, so we can maybe help each other out.
Oh, mate.
Dogs on beaches is not cool, apparently. Anyway.
Hey, Dustin, thanks for coming on the show today, mate. Really, really appreciate it. And it's good to see yourself in the wider police community out there doing some good medicine, so thank you.
Awesome, mate. Thanks very much for having me on, guys, and more than happy to follow up on any questions anyone has.
So if listeners would like to find you, where can they find you?
Mate, I'm on all the major stuff. So I'm on LinkedIn and Instagram. So you can always just look me up. I think it's – I don't even know what my
– His safer profile is a LinkedIn one. It's where all the professional stuff is. Yeah. Don't go to his Instagram.
Generally, yeah, that's right. Yeah, if you want to see photos of dogs, just go on that. So that'll be it. but LinkedIn's the way to go.
Fantastic. Thanks for coming on again, Sonny.
Yep, thank you. Enjoyed it.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions, qualms, queries or concerns, reach out to us. You can find us on our website, www.theshiftextension.org. I think that's it. See you next time.